Sasqua is a podcast about Bigfoot. It's recorded for the skeptics, the believers, the knowers, and those who just have a casual interest in the subject. For more information, visit sasquatch.com. That's me. Wood apes and comics.
They go together.
Right? A podcast about Bigfoot. I'm one of your hosts. My name is Seth Breedlove. I'm joined by my pal, Mark Matsky.
Hi there.
And tonight we are joined by Kathy Strain of the North American Wood Ape Conservancy, one of my cohorts in the group. And she's also an author. And Kathy, before we get into, you know, kind of going through this interview, I want you to tell us what it is that you do for a living, because I am absolutely fascinated by your career choice.
Oh, okay. Well, my full title is I'm Heritage Resource and Tribal Relations Program Manager for the Stanislaus National Forest in California. We're headquartered out of Sonora, California. And it's a fancy term to just say I'm the forest archaeologist, and I take care of all the tribal needs as well.
Okay, and how long have you been doing that?
I have been in the Forest Service for 24 years, and I believe I have been on the Stanislaus for 16 years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so something I wanted to know about right off the bat is, when you got that job, were you already interested in this subject of Bigfoot?
Oh, yes. Yes. My interest in Bigfoot occurred when I was very young. I saw the movie Legend of Boggy Creek, and I can't remember the age in particular that I was, but I was pretty young, and I'm really surprised now that my mom allowed me to watch it, because when you kind of look back at it, it's a little bit scary. But that movie heavy influenced me, that there was this creature out there. And around fifth or sixth grade, I asked my teacher about what would I need to do to study Bigfoot, and she suggested anthropology. And so that's the path I took, you know, but I kind of knew, you know, pretty early on I wasn't going to make a living studying Bigfoot. Nobody was going to pay me for that. And so when I started taking anthropology classes, it was just, I still was in love with the concepts and the theories, and I love Native American prehistory and dealing with, you know, site management and everything that I do. And when I was in high school, I remember that I had some friends on the Tule Indian Reservation that went to our high school, and they took us up to the res and showed us the Hairy Man pictographs. And I remember that teenager telling me the story of why those pictographs were there, and then I was just like, okay, now I can meld these two things together, you know, anthropology and Bigfoot, woo. And so that was always going to be a part of who I was. And so I was very, very fortunate that I was chosen as the archaeologist for California Hot Springs Ranger District of the Sequoia National Forest. And then it merged with the Tule River, or maybe it's just the Tule Ranger District, but in between these two districts of a national forest on the Sequoia National Forest sat the Tule Indian Reservation. So they're sandwiched in. So I did a lot of work for the tribe on behalf of the U.S. government. So I would clear projects for them, and I would do just whatever they needed done. And we, at that time, started excavating. This is, I know, a very long story, but there was an archaeological site that was at the Hot Springs Ranger District that was a beautiful prehistoric site, and we needed to excavate it because we were just hammering it. And so I would go to the elders' meetings at the tribe and talk about this. And at that time, my oldest son, who is now a father, was just a wee little lad, and he had shocking red hair. And the tribal elders just fell in love with him. And so it got to be the point where they would invite me to come to meetings just to see him because they just fell in love with him. And it was at these meetings that they just said, you know, we never met a white girl who believed in Bigfoot. And I don't remember how it came up, but they said, you know the story about the hairy man pictographs. And I said, yeah. And they go, well, you know what? Maybe you don't know all the stories. And so they allowed me at these meetings to hear these traditional stories that had never been put down on paper, that hadn't been really discussed outside their community because it was so sacred to them. And they said, you know, we want you to know about this because you're just, you know, probably just because my kid was a redhead, I don't know. And so I wrote them down, there was a process that we went through of how to get the story down, and I held on to them for many years. And, you know, and then, you know, as a archaeologist, you want to be respected among your peers, and I know people knew I was interested, but I didn't really make a move to come public. I was a part of the BFRO, but I was, you know, in the background. And it was 2003 at the Willow Creek Symposium that I kind of finally said, well, nobody's talking about Native Americans and their connection with Bigfoot. And that's where I kind of blossomed, where I kind of brought it forward and said, hey, this isn't just witness sightings. It's just not footprints. Native Americans have a belief in this, and it's deeply rooted.
Mm-hmm. Talk about that hairy man pictograph. Like, before you were, coming into contact with it, were you aware of that? Was that something that was even out in the public eye?
I would say no. The tribe is, they're the Yokuts. They call themselves the Tule River now, named after the reservation itself. But no, it was not what I would say common knowledge to the general public. I probably archaeologists knew about it. In fact, I know that one of my mentors, Gay Weisenberger, did know about it because later on, then when I went to college, I started at Porterville College, and so these pictographs are just above elevation on the reservation. Above Porterville College, and I remember taking her anthropology classes, and I remember Corey Lee saying something about Bigfoot to her, and she just went, oh, there's these hairy man the pictographs up there, and they're recorded. They're the first site ever recorded in Tulare County, and blah, blah. She just kind of spilled all this stuff out, and I was like, well, I've seen them before. She goes, well, I've been allowed to see them once, and I was like, you know, okay, and I just kind of picked her brain about what she knew, but she hadn't collected any of the stories. And that's kind of, when you're an anthropologist, sometimes you're more archaeologists and don't really want to talk to anybody, and then some of us are more anthropologists where we like talking with the people who are still around, and so that's more my style. And she hadn't spent a lot of time talking to tribal members about it, but she was aware of it. But I would say the general person in the area is not aware of them.
Okay. So when you're researching this stuff, is this kind of like something you do when you're on the job, or is this like something you're doing in your spare time, like actually picking up the stories and learning about the Native Americans' outlook on the wood ape?
I would say that 99.99% of the time I am not on the job when I'm doing it, because I'm a government employee. I work for the United States of America and for the people, and I don't think they would appreciate me using tax dollars to research Bigfoot. But it is very common when I go to a lot of tribal meetings, a lot with our local tribe, plus larger tribes when we have bigger gatherings and talking about bigger issues, and it always comes up. It just is one of those things. And I'm well known in the tribal community, and so they will seek me out and talk about it, you know, a little here and there. But if I'm going to do an interview or if I'm going to gather something, then I go off government time and I go personal time, record the data that they're telling me, and then, you know, either go back on government time or not, depending. But it's amazing what wealth of information there is that's out there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just got your book over the weekend, Giants, Cannibals, and Monsters, and it's basically kind of a collection of that's the book right there. I have it next to me. It's first of all, I was stunned by it in that it's a paperback, but it is more like the presentation reminded me of a hardcover because it's this glossy, almost cardstock paper, and it's just a very high quality Bigfoot book. And I say Bigfoot book because the typical Bigfoot book that I'm used to is, you know, some guy printed it in his garage, and I'm reading it on newsprint. And this is not this book. It's a very well put together book. And the pictures and everything are great too, especially for someone like me who's not, you know, very intelligent, has a hard time reading, gets easily distracted by photos. So I'm reading through this. There is just an insane amount of stories in this thing that contain, I guess, possible Bigfoot connections. When you're learning these stories, I'm like, as I'm reading them, I'm like trying to decipher, right? I'm like, okay, so what is, you know, is there something here that is specifically Bigfoot related, or is this sort of this kind of obtuse, you know, view of the creature? I guess I have a hard time when I'm reading it, not being part of that culture, actually understanding what they're saying about the creature. Like, can you, how do you approach it from a Native American point of view, and how do you think they approach it? Like, is this a spiritual animal to them? Is it a, you know, some sort of spirit animal? Is it an actual creature?
One thing that I think gets lost in the confusion is that those stories belong to the tribes. And so there's not a story in there that wasn't approved or vetted by the tribes themselves saying this is a Bigfoot story. Sometimes I think where it gets lost is most of these stories are from, well, not most, all of them are from after contact with European immigrants that were coming over to America and either, you know, spreading across, starting in the East and then spreading towards California and the heyday of, you know, miners, 49ers. And so what you get, Native Americans didn't have a written language. They didn't have writing. And so what they carry on is a form of oral tradition. And so by the time you get to here, the beginning of the story was way back here. And they know that part. So that's part of who they are as people. What they're continuing on with the story is now at this phase. And so sometimes we don't necessarily know the origins or the story that said, oh yeah, the, you know, Tonequah is a 7-foot hairy giant who does this. All you know is Tonequah's name itself means wild woman of the woods. So sometimes you don't get that basic story because it's 1,000, 2,000 years ago when this thing started. So all the tribes in this book, those are Bigfoot stories. What it may or may not mean is up to the reader. And I think that's what I was after was I hate reading books. And there's been more than a few where they take, you know, this much of a story and cherry pick it. And they're telling you this little line is Bigfoot. Well, what is the context of that entire story? You're picking this one little piece. Was coyote in the story? Did it happen in this area or happen in this area? And so what I wanted to present was a true anthropology book. There's thousands of anthropology books where are they're just books of stories of what the tribes had to say. And it's a scientific method of presenting data without it being tainted by me telling you that's what you should feel about it. At some point, you know, you can take the articles apart and individually say, well, this is this, 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 and this. And I do that then in my presentations when I give talks. I say, okay, so this entire story is in the book, but here's the piece you need to pay attention to. They say this landscape feature on Table Mountain or at Columbia or in Yakima is where this event happened, and here's what they say is still on the landscape that tells them that story's true. And so they kind of go hand in hand together. And sometimes I think there's stuff that you can take away. Well, I mean, there's rock throwing in there. There's Bigfoots that break branches as they're marking trails. There's stories about whistling. There's stories about them just being obnoxious and hanging around and just, you know, making themselves a nuisance. There's stories about than kidnapping children. There's stories about that. There's a very strong belief that Tonopah and other, she has lots of different names throughout the United States, of stealing children and eating them as food. There's a classic across the board, this belief system that she wore a basket on her back. And what you get away is you're getting a foundation. And then when you have the opportunity to see the dances that are specifically in the Pacific Northwest, where they have a Tonopah dance, where she, the whole entire dance is her taking her hands and sweeping something and putting it in a basket. And the elder tells you, well, she's collecting children because they were bad, and she's going to take them back to her lair and she's going to eat them. And the costume that the dancer's wearing is 100% hair-covered animal with this beautiful mask. I could probably show you a mask. I have one on my wall over here. And what else could it be? You know, and the tribe says it's Bigfoot. That looks like a Bigfoot to me. What else? I don't know what else it could be. And so it wasn't up to me to decide what Bigfoot was. There were several stories where I said, hey, tribe, don't you think this is Bigfoot? And they went, no. That's not Bigfoot. Go away over there. And I said, okay. Yeah. So...
Mark,
not all you can do, it's their culture. They have the right to say what something is.
Right, right.
Definitely. Kathy, could you talk a little bit more about the names that are given to these creatures, like the common threads in the names? I find that fascinating, you know, just the different designations that are given and what's meant, what, you know, the meaning of the names.
Sure. I mean, a very common, and I want to emphasize again too that there's probably, I have probably a whole another book full of stories that where they finally cut me off on this one. They went, okay, you know, hey, we got to lay this out, can you stop? And I went, okay, fine. So I have at least another book full, and I also have for several years now been collecting stories from South America. And they're extremely similar. And just to back up that, Native Americans are Native Americans. They crossed the Bering Land Bridge or boated. We're not entirely certain of those theories. Came down through Alaska, through Canada, and then spread across North and South America. People in South America are Native Americans, and they're no different in the bloodlines of who we have in North America. They may have other bloodlines, such as the Spanish, interwoven with them, just like Native Americans here have European or Dutch or Russian or whatever it is, but they're still Native Americans. And their stories are very similar. And so there's very common to have names like in South America, you have Sataruna, which is a wild man, or let's see, wild man of the jungle, or you have wild man of the woods, or you have wild woman of the woods, or you have whistling woman. Those translations, they know what they mean. And they're usually very distinctive. There is even a term that comes back as being Bigfoot, that's how they knew what he was and how they designated him. And, you know, depending on what kind of relationship the tribe had, you know, not everything is fluffy and beautiful in prehistory. Are you still okay? Can you guys still hear me?
Yep.
Okay, just froze up a little bit.
Sorry.
But their names often reflect how they felt about Bigfoot. And so Hairy Man for the Yokuts, you know, his name, and I'm not going to try to say it, but Maidak Detek, reflects that they had a good relationship, versus other names are like, ooh, you know, that his traditional name would mean, oh, just stay away from him because he's a cannibal, or he's a devil, he's a wild thing that you don't want to have anything to deal with.
So some of these native tribes, do you think is there an across the board this thing is evil, or is there an across the board it's good, or is it something in between?
There is no across the board anything. Okay. And that's so each tribe is individual. And so you have tribes that had very good relationships, as they report in their stories and still today, that he's cool, he's important to them, he has a cultural role, like as in Tonopah in the Pacific Northwest, as is a Hairy Man to the Yokuts. He is important to them and provides a service that they need to have culturally so that certain things happen throughout the year. then you have, like, the local tribe I work with here, the Miwok, where he doesn't have any role whatsoever, and they don't want to have anything to do with them. And a good example of that is we have a cave on our national forest, it's Pinnacle Point Cave, that has roughly 10,000 artifacts and about 100 individuals in it. And despite my every attempt to get that back to the tribe through NAGPRA, the Native American Graves and Repatriation Act, probably not getting that all right, they don't want them because their belief system is that Bigfoot always lived in caves. And there's no way that they ever deposited bones in a cave. And so those bones represent people that Bigfoot ate, and they don't want to have anything to do with it. And so, you know, you kind of get stuck between a rock and a hard place with those kinds of things. And so with the National Park Service, I have to report to them. I go, tribe said Bigfoot ate these people and they don't want it back. And the National Park Service goes, okay, we're good with it. No big deal.
Ohio. Mark and I are both in Ohio. There's traditionally, people talk about those Stonish Giants from Ohio as being Bigfoot related. I have not got that far in your book. I don't even know if you get into really like Ohio history.
Do you know what tribe it is?
Mark, is it Iroquois or Delaware? Maybe. It might be Delaware. The Stonish Giants, it's also Janosqua. I think people typically will talk about Janosqua as being, what do you think?
Yeah, there is stories from that general area, and there were some interesting ones about a giant rolling head. I think that's the area. Yep. I can't off the top of my head think of – I know that there are some stories for sure that they – but they're very – you know, one – I think an important thing to remember is that all tribes as well as individuals in those tribes have different life experiences, and how they describe something isn't always going to be the same. And I think that's – can be frustrating to a Bigfooter where, one time I interviewed a lady and she didn't know how else to tell me what she saw other than to say, you know those upright walking circus bears? And I'd go, yeah, I've seen those on television. She goes, that's what it looked like. It was a bear walking upright, but it wasn't a bear. And so somebody would say, oh, that person is really just describing a bear, but she was insistent it wasn't that. So tribal people can only describe something they have a word for, you know, like, when you go to Hawaii, there's no native word for spam. It's just spam because it was never part of their tradition. And so if you don't have a word that describes every element of a Bigfoot, you're not going to be able to tell somebody that. And so, and not only that is that tribal, but that's also individual. And so in particular with those Ohio stories, you would find some that were very clearly, and I remember there was a little bit of a battle about that, where there were some tribal members that were saying, no, it's not a Bigfoot, and other ones that were saying yes. And so I included them. I had the same issue, I believe, on the Navajo reservation, where I had a few people who were saying, we don't believe in Bigfoot, we never had a Bigfoot, and some other Navajo that were just adamant that, yes, they did. And so they're not necessarily everywhere is a united force. It just depends on what you learned growing up through your elder, and that's who you learn from is your elder.
Mm-hmm. Mark?
Which makes me your elder. No, I'm kidding. I have totally lost a picture with you.
It's okay. Oh. It's coming and going. It's been doing it since before we started.
Okay.
Hopefully we don't drop. Mark?
You know, when you were talking about how the elders shared stories with you kind of off the record, is there anything about those that you can talk about, or is that something you'd rather, you know, protect out of respect for them? It's fascinating to me.
No, actually, there's a little that I have never shared with anybody because it's to some degree because I don't really understand it, and so I try not to present stuff I can't explain. But those stories are actually in the book. Okay. They're and published in a story on the Relic Hominid Inquiry that Meldrum is the editor for. And then there's also I have a song. It's the Hairy Man song that only women can sing. And I have a recording of that. And I have a few things that I've never talked about and that are just going to always be a part of me, and I just not going to share because, like I said, some I understand, but most of it I just have never wrapped my head around it. Mm-hmm. And so and if I said it, somebody would go, "What?" And I go, "I don't know. I can't explain it either." So it's just better for me not to talk about it.
Right. But that is, I think, a sign of the trust level that you would have to develop in order to, be brought into that world.
Yeah, I think very much so, and I get a lot of those stories today because of the same reasons where I'm considered trustworthy and I don't make fun of anybody, and doesn't mean I believe every single thing a Native person tells me, because to some, even in the book, Bigfoot has two sides. He has a definite physical being where he gets the term brother, and there's a spiritual side where he has the ability, just like any other animal, deer, condor, eagle, to come to you in dreams and give you lessons or give you advice. And so to me, of course, even though I'm a spiritual person, it's difficult for me to believe that Bigfoot really would come to me in my dreams, because he's a spiritual being, and give me something, a task to do.
That would be pretty awesome, though.
It would be pretty awesome. But I don't know, unless what he told me to do was really awful.
Yeah,
but,
like putting children in baskets or eating someone.
Hey, put your new grandbaby out in a basket.
Yikes.
I don't think that's a good idea. Yeah. So there's definitely things that I am religious, but I'm also a scientist. And so I have to balance those things in order to get to the truth. I'm not judgmental of it, and I will include it because that's what you say you believe. Doesn't mean mm-hmm. I believe it. I don't believe for one second that Bigfoot has the ability to cloak or what does he do? What else does he do?
Ride in UFOs.
Do what?
Ride in UFOs.
Ride in UFOs. Ride a moose.
Is that really a thing? Do they say?
Oh, yeah. Some guy said that I saw a Bigfoot trying to get on the back of a moose. And I was like, dude, come on. That moose is just going to stand there and go, "Hey, Bigfoot, you want to ride, dude? Come on." No. I mean, there's worse. There's the mild stuff. It's always my favorite one is the lady who took a picture behind her back because she didn't want to scare the Bigfoot, and had proof of Bigfoot existing, and the picture shows mushrooms that grow after rain, and she kept saying the Bigfoot was under the mushroom.
Oh.
So it's like, well,
tiny.
Wow. Tiny. That's a tiny, tiny Bigfoot.
It's like a Polly Pocket Bigfoot.
Mm-hmm.
So, Kathy, you work for the Forest Service. Do you take part in covering up the existence then?
Oh, yeah. I shred all day long. I'm so sick of shredding. Please, God, give me something else to do. It's either that or the big black markers going, shh.
Yeah. Redacted.
And that's even the most funny part is because having worked for the U.S. government for 24 years, I'm still sane, which is amazing, because do you ever want to be frustrated? You get a U.S. Forest Service laptop, and you try to work on it. It's so funny, because I probably, they're paying me for at least 2 hours of just, we're looking at that wheel of death going on and on. I'm like, we can't keep a secret to save our lives, and I've never, every boss I've ever had, everybody I've ever known knows what I do. I recently got a phone call from Fire Patrol to tell me about a guy who told them about a Bigfoot experience he had just in October. And they had no qualms calling me and talking about it. There is no cover-up. There is nobody telling anybody you're going to lose your job. A lot of people don't know this, but once you've been in the U.S. government for 1 year, it is almost impossible to fire you. You would have to basically rape somebody in the office, get busted for the biggest drug thing you ever did in your entire life, I mean, kill somebody, something like that. You insubordination doesn't even get you fired. You might get some nasty little write-ups and some like, hey, you better behave. But there, nobody can say, Kathy, you believe in Bigfoot. If you talk about Bigfoot, blah, 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 I'm going to fire you. It's not going to happen. My job is secure. I could run around crazy in the office and probably never do another lick of work. And there's nothing anybody can do about it. Morally, I wouldn't do that. But I'm just saying that it's... Yeah. You guys just don't know the government. We don't get rid of people. We actually promote you when you're crazy. We make you more in charge of things. That's what we do.
Wow.
So just letting you know, no, there is no cover-up. We couldn't cover it up even if we tried because you can't corral people. People talk. I've never seen anything that's called secret ever, ever contained, ever.
Hmm. Mark, you want to hop in?
Yeah, sure. From an archaeological perspective, what are some of the most interesting things you've worked on? You know, Bigfoot related or not?
Well, Bigfoot related would be the hairy man pictographs, and of course, right. There's totem poles and masks and dances that are just exquisite. Not only because they represent tribal history, but just that it's so beautiful to me that culture continues. You know, as an American, I'm Irish. Hi, sweetie, and. But I don't really have a connection with that Irish background of mine, so I don't have things that belong to my culture. I have an American culture, but I don't have something that's older than, you know, a couple hundred years. And so for some culture to have something that's older than thousands of years to me is just unbelievable. But probably last year, you may have heard of something called the Rim Fire. And it was the largest fire to occur on in the Sierras, and I think probably the third in California, but it was 257,000 acres. And where we live here in Sonora, we're about an hour's drive, hour and a half probably, to the bottom valley of Yosemite. That fire literally burned from just outside our doorstep. I could see where it burned on this ridge behind us, all the way through to Yosemite and then into the wilderness. And it started August 17th, 2013. We finally declared it out in October 2014. So massive. Loss of habitat is unbelievable. But archaeologically, it's been unbelievable. Just unbelievable. I have now seen artifacts I have never seen in my life. I have seen material. I don't know what the material is. We finally got it identified, but it was just like, I don't know what this is. Sites, our prehistoric sites have just been utterly phenomenal. Just one site, we have over 200 projectile points collected just off the surface. And the range of those have gone somewhere to 7,000 to modern day, where there was arrowheads that were made of glass. And so the correct term is projectile points. That's what I should have said. You can now see, one day I was standing on a mountain just outside of Yosemite, and I could look across the California Valley, and I could see the coast and see Mount Diablo. And you're like going, oh, my God, that's a view, because there's no now trees in my way that I can see. And one day I was standing at the origin of the fire, and I looked up, and I could see El Capitan of Yosemite. And oh, wow. So those experiences have been just phenomenal. For I'm tired, and I would kind of like it to go away now. But it's been it makes you see the forest for the trees, and it also makes you realize that Native people really knew what the hell they were doing. They knew the waterways. They knew when plants would be coming up. They knew what resources were at what spot at what time. They could go, you know, 100 miles uphill, and they would get back to that same site they needed to be back in for the winter. And because the bedrock mortars where they were grinding oak acorns constantly, that they had to be hundreds of years deep. So they were masters of the landscape. And if you're a master of a landscape, why would you make up a creature for what purpose? Mm-hmm. What purpose did you make up a Bigfoot to have in your stories? Because what did it get you? Because I'm pretty sure if I want to scare my kid, I can probably just tell you, if you go outside the firelight, that bear is going to eat you. You know?
Yeah.
I mean, or you're going to get bit by a rattlesnake or X or Y. I mean, you didn't need to make up something that was 7 foot tall and hair covered. I mean, I don't know what that gets you.
Right. I mean, hearing you describe that, it makes me want to live that way. You know, well, it's like, man, that's amazing.
It is amazing. And not that I took a year off. I was grateful that I made it into Area X. I was in there in June. The fire happened in August. Had I scheduled myself for later, I wouldn't obviously not have been able to go because it was, it consumed everything in our lives, in our, thank God for my husband, who I wasn't getting home until like 11 o'clock at night and leaving at 7:30 in the morning. And there was food in the freezer for them to eat, or else, you know, it was chaos because it was unprecedented. And just to pat myself on the back a little bit, we did use that opportunity to get students out into that landscape so they could see what archaeology looks like when it's not covered in duff or brush or all that stuff, where you could literally see the ground and you can make sense of what it is that you're seeing. Yeah. Of course,
go ahead.
No, go ahead.
All right, let's talk about the Area X, as long as you're bringing it up, because it's one of my favorite subjects.
You knew you were going
to
bring it up.
And this is a total shock to me. I don't. The conversation just naturally went in this direction. So, Area X, you've been going in there for how long?
We first started going in. We went for a week in 2012. Together, and then Bob, my husband, went for 3 weeks in 2013 by himself. Well, he had a friend with him, but he didn't go with me. And that spread from April into May, and then I went for 3 weeks by myself with other team members, but without my husband. And then this year we spent 2014 two additional weeks. So we've been in there 6 weeks, essentially.
Okay. Tell us about some of the things you've experienced there.
Well, I've had a sighting. So, just to back up, we normally Bigfoot. I don't know. Is that a verb? I'm not particularly sure.
I mean, people say it. People also say squatching, though, and that makes me want to pull my own nose hairs out.
So we do a lot of stuff in California. We have. We used to do a lot of research around Lake Tahoe, but it got to be too hard of a drive with the kids. And so we Bigfooted in an area that is now within the rimfire footprint. And so that habitat's been lost. And we've had lots of great experiences there. There's stories galore we could tell. But outside for me, I've been screamed at. I've seen footprints many times. I've seen broken branches. I've had all kinds of experiences, but never a sighting. So we were in Area X in 2012, and there were with Brian Brown and Mark McClurkin and Ken. What's Ken's last name?
Helmer?
No, the other Ken.
I don't know.
Oh, I'm having a... He's going to kill me. Don't show him this.
Say Ken X.
Ken Stewart. Ken Stewart. And we were there. We got there on a Sunday, and that next Monday, and it's a very long story, but to shorten it down, they had thought something was going on at one spot at what we call the – wait a minute, I got to write my directions so I don't mess up and use words I shouldn't use. They thought something was going on at the West Cabin, had gone there, and left me alone because they're just, you know, don't take the girl with you. And while I was standing there for, you know, 10, 15, 20 minutes, I had turned, you know, looking at my bag, making sure nothing's behind me. And, of course, you know, I'm always armed, and everybody in the group is armed. And I had turned to see something, if there was anything behind me, and when I turned back, I saw a branch that was like this, slowly get let back, and I could see something dark behind it, and I kept my eyes on it, and I was like, that's interesting. Anyway, the boys radioed back. They were coming back, and I said, okay, well, something weird happened. When you come back, I'm going to have you check a bush for me. You know, it wasn't really a bush. It was kind of a tree, but not like a tree. It was more like what I would say willow or a very branchy, very leafy, but not one single stock kind of tree. And I said, okay, you guys are at the tree, bush. Can you look and see if something's in there? And Brian and Mark had gone around it to kind of see, and they just kind of went, oh, no, there's nothing in there. I can see the path where something would escape. My husband looked, and he didn't see anything. It was a little before 6 o'clock, and the shadows were starting. And then something got thrown onto the south cabin and hit the roof. And so everybody but Bob and I went over to inspect it, because that's what you do in Area X. When somebody throws a rock, you go and run and do their bidding and see what's going on. And I had Bob check again. I said, seriously, dude, are you sure? And he sticks his head in there and goes, honey, there's nothing in here but a couple of logs. And I said, okay, well, they got away from us and whatever. So they all come back. We're sitting down around a makeshift stone like fire pit. It's not, you know, nothing constructed. It doesn't have like cement or anything. It's just one row of rocks that defines where you have your fire. And I'm sitting looking down what we call the bottleneck. And then it's Bob and Brian. Mark McClurkin is sitting horizontal to us, and then Ken's sitting horizontal. And we start hearing this weird like brush moving kind of sound, and we're like, well, you know, that sounds like something bipedal, and we're like listening. And then all of a sudden, there they were. There was a big one and a little one, and they were coming through, you know, through the bottleneck, the side of the mountain. I should draw this just because nobody ever understands what I'm talking about. So here's, I mean, oh, hold on. I did something else on that page that nobody should see. It's like, this stuff guy is crazy. No, I didn't write that. Anyway, so this would be called the bottleneck, and here's the mountain as it goes up. So they're right, you know, coming at us, but riding this contour, so not going uphill at all. They're just coming at us like they're trying to get to the back of a shed that's right here. And, of course, me, because I am me, I jump up and I say, there they are, and I run at them. I was going to get them in a headlock, I guess. I don't know what I was going to do.
Yeah.
And there was a motion camera looking exactly at the place, and all you get is my butt. That's what triggered it. So thank God we erased that, so there's no evidence of that. The second I start moving, and Bob, Brian, and Mark McClurkin all see the same thing, poor Ken goes, what do you mean that's where they are? And he kind of stands up, and the outhouse blocks his view, and he doesn't know why everybody's running, and pretty much. I love razzing him about it. And the second that I then start at them, they go up that hillside like it was nothing. It's like somebody took a bungee cord and they just went boop. They all sound stopped. Movement was, I mean, if I believed in ghosts, I would have told you they were ghosts, because I can't imagine how they made it up that hillside like that. And I only had so much time, and I totally at first, I mean, I just tuned out the little one, just went, I'm not paying any attention to you. And it took me a while to even recognize that I had seen two, because I was so focused on the one, because you know this only lasts for seconds. And it was huge. It was covered in black hair. Its skin color was the same color of its hair. And as it turned to go up the hill, it put its fist like this and put it to his side like he was just trudging in, and he bent forward and went up that hillside that fast, and it had the hugest buttocks and thighs of anything I've ever seen. It was just pure muscle. And I think it must have gone up, I think we determined a log, because I saw its feet temporarily go like this in order to climb up, get across a log. Then there's a lot of dead and down in there. And then there was just kind of this other blur that went up that was the little one that I did not get a good view of at all and don't really have a lot of memory of because I was so awestruck by the big one. And there's actually a film of me where the entire I'm going like this. And they're going, what'd you see? What'd you see? I'm like, I mean, I was just, my whole body almost had a total shutdown. And it very unladylike ways, I started cussing at the hillside because it was making me feel better. I was just like, blah, 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 just blah, you know, just like, you can't do that to me, you know, kind of thing. And I remember I challenged him to do something, and I don't, it was just because my whole system was shutting down. And Brian's asking me, Kathy, you did you see too? And I said, what are you talking about? You know, it was a big one. It was a big one. And finally I go, oh, yeah, there was two. Is that what you're talking about? And he goes, yeah. And I was like, okay. It was just, it was such a shock. It'd be the equivalent of me sitting here at my house and seeing somebody dressed in black and ninja with a gun walking through my backyard. I'd be going, that's just not happening right now. You know, I always wanted to see a Bigfoot, and here I got that opportunity. You know, at least I got up and ran at them. I mean, that's a little more dignity than, you know, me crying like a little girl. But and then the rest of the week was filled with, like, lots of rock throws, wood knocks. It was constant, just constant. And the second year was even more intense. It was I almost say for this last year, 2014, that I'm jaded because of what happened in 2013, even though you still get activity and you're reading your notes, and I go, well, yeah, there was rock throws and there's stuff, but dang it, you know, if it's not constant, I'm just, like, mad about it. And so in 2013, I was there with Brian Brown and Monica Rollins and the Shannons, and I was sitting on the back porch of the cabin that we use, and I see this tree just bouncing all over the place, and I'm like, oh, God, well, there's something in that tree. And then out onto a branch comes this, about 30 pounds is what I guess. I could be wrong, but if I could get my dog in here, I'd show you the size because we call it the Shelby size. Perfectly flat black back, no tail whatsoever, black. And it gets out onto the limb, and it purposefully, it has its hands gripped around the branch, and it purposefully starts the branch to bounce. It gets it bouncing, and then goes like this. Meow, across what we called the bottleneck and into another tree that was fairly close. And I was like, at first I went, oh, I just saw a chimp jump in the tree. And I went, chimp? Wait a minute, that's not a chimp. And so I grabbed Brian and we run down there. Now you can see is the path that it took, that all these other trees are shaking. And then the main tree that it jumped into, you can see it jumped down here. And up here are broken branches. So it's obviously, when it was thinner, could jump higher into that tree, broke the branch, and so the next time it jumped to the next lower branch until it was too heavy for that branch, broke it. You know, so there's all, it's obvious that that's what it was doing. And that whole 3 weeks, just rock throw after rock throw, wood knocks, just craziness. I mean, it was at the end of that 3 weeks, I felt like I had been in Vietnam, you know, where I was just like, you know, had enough at that point. So,
what is it about Area X that's so special, do you think? You know, is it that, I mean, is it the habitat? What is it about the habitat? What is it in general just about that location?
I think it's the habitat. I think it's the location. It's very remote. I know so many people are just so skeptical, and they think they know where we're at, and they don't have a clue where we're at. And they have no true concept of remoteness. And I come across that a lot. I know a lot of people who take day trips, and they think they know what, you know, the forest looks like, and they never get more than, you know, 10 minutes away from their car. But it's it takes more than an hour to drive into it because of the condition of the roads. There's no electricity. There is no phone. We had a cell phone booster this year that really helped so that we could get out at nighttime. You couldn't get out during the day. But there is a generator that you can, or batteries that lets you, not a true generator, but a battery set that's hooked into it that uses solar that allows you to have some electricity, but essentially you're on your own, and there's an outhouse. You don't have indoor plumbing, although the shower was working and pouring cold water over you this past year. Then there's not much else. It's then just a valley that doesn't have hardly anybody go to it. There's not, you know, there's not a place that the general public goes to or visits or anything to that. And so they, I think, have a lot of peace that they can live there without interruptions. And yet there's something about our presence there that they find very attractive. And they can't help but stay around there. And the rock throws in particular, you'll notice that when we've been in the cabin asleep, maybe we slept in a little bit, and they're getting antsy about, like, well, you're not up yet. And so throwing the rocks to get us to come outside so they can just see what we're doing. I mean, that's how it feels sometimes. And sometimes it feels like they throw rocks or do wood knocks to divert us to a certain area when the attraction is back over here. And that was the other thing that I didn't finish about the story about the my first sighting, is then obviously those animals had come from that bush, that tree. They had been there the entire time because they came right from it. And what happened the next day is I come outside, and Brian and Bob both have their mouths up and going like this, and I'm like, okay, what happened? And Bob goes, what did I tell you yesterday about that bush? And I said, well, you said there's just a couple of logs in there. And he goes, guess how many logs there are now? And I said, oh, my God, are you trying to tell me that you were inches away from them the entire time and they had just been laying on the ground still, and because of the shadows, you didn't notice that it was a Bigfoot? They were just logs. Yeah. You believe me, we've tortured him for years over that, you know, but we have this theory, we have this thing called shoot the logs, make sure it's a log. And so, and that doesn't surprise me. I think they use the elements of laying, just like anything. I remember one time I was in the field and I had totally walked up on a deer who had nestled herself down into brush. She was the same color as, it was actually grass, as dry grass. And she let me come right up on her, and she wasn't going to move no matter what she did because she had a little fawn and she had just given birth. And I didn't see her until I was right on her because she blended so well with the landscape. And for me, that was what that felt like to me, was is it just sit still, blend. And there's all kinds of other stories where somebody said they thought, myself even, I think maybe years ago, I had an experience where I thought something was a trash bag because it was black and just sitting still, and then later on that it wasn't there anymore. And, you know, but I don't know for sure, and so I don't talk about it or count it for anything because it could have just been me who thought I saw a trash bag or whatever. You know, it happened too fast. But I suspect that might happen a lot more than we think, that I'm a stump, I'm just sitting here, I'm not doing anything, and then when they get the opportunity to move, they move. So anyway, that was, I wanted to finish that story so somebody could harass Bob later on.
I'll do that. Shoot the logs. So are you telling me you want to shoot a Bigfoot?
Yes.
let's talk about that.
Okay.
Why do you want to shoot a Bigfoot, Kathy?
To preserve Bigfoot as a species. If you have traveled throughout the United States, and why I always bring up the Rim Fire is because the events of catastrophic wildfires are getting worse and worse each year. We, as the Forest Service, as the U.S. Park Service, as the Bureau of Land Management, as all these federal agencies who manage land for the public, we're convinced back in, I'd say, the 1900s, that allowing fire to burn naturally on the landscape was wrong. Anytime there was fire, you put it out. So we didn't allow the ecosystem to perform as an ecosystem. We, as humans, interfered with that system. Because we have done that, we have created a challenge. There is so many acres that where the trees are too dense, the brush is too thick, the tree species itself is wrong for the elevation. We're not able, with the funding that we have in manpower, to reintroduce fire into the landscape and manage it without it getting out of control. We do prescribe fires, but we're never at the rate it's been calculated, we would have to burn so many, like 20, I think it's 20,000 acres, or maybe even be more per year, just to try to keep up with what we, the damage we've already done by suppressing it. Well, the general public doesn't like fire. So when you let 20,000 acres up, they go, what are you doing? So in response to that, we have these catastrophic wildfires where you leave, instead of 20,000 acres, you lose 300,000 acres. And so the Sierras in particular, which is major Bigfoot habitat this year, so we lost the 257,000 acres from the Rim Fire. Next door to us, we had the King Fire that was over 100,000 acres. And then there's other fires that happened throughout the year that burned great acreage. So by that, you're reducing habitat and you're making animals and other species compete for the available resources, because it's not just water. You have to have food and you have to have shelter and you have to have protection. And on top of that, then when you go to other places, you're starting to see private land companies who can clear cut land. I mean, it's amazing what's happening. Where it's just, even one of these days I'm going to go out and I'm going to take some, the Sierra Pacific Industries owns this big chunk of private property within the Rim Fire, and it's slicked off. There ain't nothing standing no more. So you're talking about, 10,000 acres within that where there's not even a tree standing anymore. At least for the Forest Service, we're selective, you know, in what we take. And so it will have trees again 100 years from now, you know, where it becomes something that somebody wants to use. But that's happening everywhere across the United States because we have a insatiable desire and need for wood products. And I'm not saying that's wrong. I'm just saying there's a sustainable way of doing that and there's an unsustainable way of doing that. And in the meantime, every animal that exists is caught within that chaos of, they're taking 100 acre share, they're taking 100 acre share. Oh, there's my food, there's my water, there's my access. And so at any point, if you have a species that's not documented, you're putting them at risk. And that's where we feel, myself, my husband, the NAWAC, are at. We're in a critical time crunch here that we need to prove the species as a whole is real through obtaining a body, doing it the scientific way, the humane way, and giving that to science, not selling, we're not about money, giving it to science so that they can study the one, we only need one, and having the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service determine that that species is indeed endangered and declaring it a species and then getting some protections in place. And so yes, we would like to kill one. It would be great if one of them would like to just lay down in our back of our truck and just say, hey, I ain't feeling well today. Just take me away. But we all know that's not going to happen. And decomposition in the open is quick. And you know what? And I hate to say this. Most people wouldn't recognize a bone if they gnawed on it. I mean, you wouldn't believe the strange things that come into me to be identified. Today I have a gentleman come in. It was a naturally weathered rock, and he was convinced it was part. And you're just like, okay, weathering, you know. So, and I get people bring me soup bones, you know, from a roast, a 7-bone roast, and go, oh, this human remains. You're like, really? So there's no way the general public as a whole is going to recognize Bigfoot remains for what it is and give it to science. It just is not going to happen, and people just need to get over it.
Okay, so let's see. One is killed tomorrow and proven to science. What changes do you see coming to our wild places if that happens?
Well, I think that he would he's neither a he nor she. He's many. But the species as a whole will get protected, as long as it comes out right. I mean, you can't do the – and, of course, Rick Dyer is a liar, so it didn't make any difference. But say he really did have a body, which is completely impossible. But to take it on a sideshow or try to sell it or whatever, that would be the worst-case scenario, because it has to get into the hands of science. It has to get to the right people who are recognized, who have the credentials, who know how to describe a body – Because it's not just, oh, I have a Bigfoot body. You have to do all kinds of work, you know, on a brain, trachea, vocal cords, dexterity of the hands. There's all kinds of stuff that need to be learned. And the highest bidder isn't going to do that. The highest bidder, I'm fearful what they would do. But as far as our wild spaces, we already have spotted owl. We have all kinds of species we manage the forest for. We would have to do a long-term study that the government would fund, thankfully, that would, I believe most of those times those are 5 to 10 year studies where biologists and anthropologists hopefully are included, not just biologists. That might be a fight over who he belongs to, you know, is it biology or is it anthropology? But they would fund a study to put people in the field to do long-term habitat and behavioral observations, just like what we do with chimps or any other species. And what we would hope is that Area X would be that location where we know they already are, so let's bring science there once we prove that he's real, and use that as your classroom and study, hopefully get, you know, additional eyewitness accounts, additional evidence of scat or hair or whatever else, and maybe observe juveniles or babies' behavior, all those things that go with that. And I don't like to use the word habituation because most people who believe in that they have a habituation situation are crazy, and so I don't like using that term, but that's what it's going to take. It's a Jane Goodall level of a study that needs to occur, and we can't get there until you get the body.
Mm-hmm. All right, Mark, final questions. I'm going to let you start to wrap up.
I've done all the talking.
That's a good thing.
That's why we're having you on.
Oh, okay.
It's a night off for us.
More of you and less of us is a good thing.
I noticed my husband has the heat up, so hopefully my face isn't too pink and rosy from the heater blowing right on me, but it feels good. It's cold tonight.
Yeah. It's cold here, too. My wife, yeah. I came home from work today. This is totally off topic. Came home from work today to find the house was 61 degrees. A balmy 61. And I'm like, how do you do this? Because she works from home. She just sits here in the 61-degree house, and that's how she likes it.
Well, it's usually at my work, they usually have the heater up, and it's like 85, and the heater sits literally, like this heater is just right behind me, but the heater sits like right here and blows on me, and I can't tell a hot flash from just being too hot. So I go, is this a hot flash, or am I just like sweaty? I don't know.
So. We've both been there too, so. Mark?
Yep. Well, Kathy, what's next for you? Do you have any plans for future writing?
Oh, well, you know, I do. I have so much I have to do. Hold my head down in shame. I owe an article to the NAWAC about some very interesting bedrock outcrops. There's two in Area X that had an obvious hand tool on it. I'm not saying constructed. It's not a manufactured tool, but it was utilized just like what a chimp would utilize a twig to go into a termite mound to pull out termites. This object had clearly been used to smash some black walnut open. And so I did a little bit of a study on it just to say, well, yeah, if in anthropology we would say that that was tool use. It's not tool construction, but it's tool use. Mm-hmm. And I've been meaning to write that up, but, you know, the rim fire happened, and so I have all kinds of excuses. And I really need to do something with the South American stories because they're amazing. They're really amazing stories, and I'd like to make the connection between North America and South America that, you know, when you start looking at this stuff, you know, what's the chances that Peru has a story of the wild man in the jungle and his description matches in British Columbia, wild man of the woods?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure they don't have the internet back, you know, 100 years ago. Mm-hmm. So how does that stuff happen? So those are my fantasy desires, which are never going to happen. But other than that, then I think for this coming summer, my grandbaby arrived early, so that's off my, in a sense, it wasn't, it was upcoming, but it was going to be limiting what we could do. But my oldest son will graduate college in May, and my youngest son will graduate high school in June. Mm-hmm. And so we may stay close to home and not go to Ariex this year, which really depresses me, and I'm still trying to find a way to make that happen. Mm-hmm. But we may head up to the Browns property that is in Washington. You've heard of the Brown Thermal?
Yeah.
That's been taken, and we have an invite to go up there, and I would like to see that territory and see if maybe we have an Area X closer to us than where it is now. Hmm. But we'll see. I'm one of those people that just goes with the flow. So,
Where can people go to get your book?
Well, you can go to Hancock House Publications. Or you can go to Amazon and only get it from Hancock. Don't buy those other people who are listed on there, because I think those are kind of shady, and they have them for – do not pay more than $40 for it, please. Somebody on eBay or something must have a signature, and it's going for like $100-something, and you're just like, really, dude? Come on. Don't buy that. If you buy it, discounted, whatever, send it to me. I'll autograph it for you and send it back.
It's actually me, but
what? Hey, I don't get a piece of that. No, I'm kidding.
Talk a little bit about the Alliance of Independent Bigfoot Researchers.
Sure, we were the very first ever 503C. I always forget what the numbers are. Nonprofit organization, and so we, you can donate to us as well. And it's a tax write-off. And so what we do is our entire goal versus the NAWAC is about species conservation. They are also a nonprofit as well. The AIBR is about education and science. We need people to be doing better science out there. So I have had, and maybe I'm just an impatient person, but I've had my fill of being sent evidence that is so poorly documented, I can't tell you anything about it. So I get hairs randomly in the mail, and I'll go, well, what's this? And the person will go, well, that's this hair I found in the forest. Well, do you have a picture of it before you gathered it? What makes you think it's Bigfoot related? And I always get this, like, well, you know, I just found this hair out in the forest. And I'll be like, okay, so you spent like 25 cents wasting my life by putting it in the mail. Or I'll get a recording that's an owl. Let me shake the camera. Learn what an owl sounds like. I swear if I get one more, pick you out. And then it even count the ambiguous footprint photographs. It don't even have a ruler next to it. So that's the goal of that organization, is to say, hey, if this is what you want to do, if you want to document Bigfoot evidence, then please use these protocols to do it. Please use our sound library, where you can actually find out what an owl sounds like and what kind of owl it is, and you can distinguish that between an owl and a Bigfoot, because 99.999% it's an owl. And just other stuff like that, like how to take a good photograph, how to cast a footprint so that it can be then looked at by somebody who knows what they're talking about and tell you if it's a bear, because most of the time it's a bear. It's a double tap. You know how to learn what a double tap is. And so it's just the encouragement that Bigfooting isn't just done from your chair. If you're going to go outside, do it right, because otherwise you're just wasting all our time. And you may be the one who gets that absolute perfect piece of DNA that settles the argument that we don't have to get a body, because you got the best something that proves it, but you picked it up and you licked it, and you went blah, 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 like this, and then your DNA is on it. You know, do you have me? Oh, I can't even tell you how many times I've seen people hold evidence like this and go, like this, and they don't even know. You know, you have germs. You know, you have DNA that's coming out within your breath. So it's just that be more scientific. Have gloves. Have a camera. Have a ruler. Document everything. Take a journal. I mean, my God, these cost 70 cents. Get a few. Write down the time. Write down the day. Write down what happened so that a year from now, when you're trying to remember stuff, you can go back to your journal and say, this is exactly when this happened. And so I recommend that regardless. You don't have to go to the AIBR website to learn that, but those materials are there for you to use and utilize.
Awesome. All right. Okay, Kathy, thanks for coming on, and we will have you on again someday, Lord willing.
I hope so.
Join the conversation at facebook.com/sasswhat. Find us on Twitter by using the hashtag sasswhat, or you can find me on Twitter at Seth Breeds Love. Mark Matsky is on Twitter at Reverend Matsky. Send your letters to sasswhatmail@gmail.com and leave us a rating and review on iTunes.